mics are live.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, March 29, 2000. It is 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, March 29, 2018. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, North Dakota Public Service Commission, and with me is Brian Karasius, and calling in today is Commissioner Julie Fedorchak. So we have everybody involved, and this is an informal hearing on case number PU-11-69, Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC and the New Frontier Wind Energy Project. And we're here to discuss the topsoil segregation requirements. Before we have anything else, even the people present or on the phone, I just want to emphasize that this is an informal hearing, so it involves only undisputed facts. If we get into disputed facts, we'll have to issue a notice of hearing and go to a formal process. First thing that we will do, Commissioner Karasius, did you have any opening comments or anything like that?
I do not.
Okay, and then Julie, rather than muting and unmuting, I'll just hold you with yours. And we'll go around the room here and identify everybody so that you know who's in the room just as we do. And so, and also I just advise everybody, these mics aren't real sensitive, so you need to speak into it fairly closely so you're picked up. So if we can go around the room, we'll start with Jerry here, and everyone identify yourselves.
Jerry Lynn with PSC staff.
I'm Molly Smith with Frederickson and Byron here on behalf of Capital Power.
Dan Moeller with Capital Power.
Yabo Gelsted with, I'm the manager of the South McHenry Soil Conservation District in Velva.
Joe Griffiths with Capital Power.
Gerald, was it?
Joe.
Bill Erickson with Blattner Energy.
Jason Oberg with Blattner Energy, engineer.
Casey, don't be shy.
Thank you. Casey Fury, Crowley Fleck.
Derek Broughton with Broughton Law Firm.
And we also have Steve Call, man of the electronics. I will say Casey and Derek are not with the group here. You're here, I believe, just monitoring. I don't have any opening comments either, so I'll turn it over to you, Julie. Julie, are you still connected?
Sorry.
Okay.
I didn't unmute correctly. Continuation of a discussion that we had at one of our, either we had a previous work session or an admin portion of one of our meetings. We had a discussion of this. I can't remember which place we started this conversation, but I think that the company has information to bring back to us based on some questions that we had with discussion with Jerry. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Jerry, and the company to provide the information that you wanted to let us have during this informal.
From staff here, we also have Patrick Fawn and Jack Hsu in the room, but Jerry?
Well, I think the issues had kind of boiled down to the road construction and how to segregate the topsoil off of there. And so I just turn it over to the company and let them say what they propose to do.
Jerry, could you also provide the context again for what has the company requested, and
sure,
remind us where we are at in whatever request has been received from the company and what our next steps need to be at some point?
Okay, we don't have any official requests from the company. Say that again.
I can explain.
Molly will talk.
Hi, Commissioner Fedorchak. This is Molly Smith. as a little background, so we had initially asked a question about the manner of road construction and just wanted to confirm that it was consistent with the topsoil segregation provision in the certification. And then there was discussion at a couple of administrative meetings. I know there was an initial discussion, and then Jerry went and requested some additional information from folks. And when it came back, it seemed that there was a bit of uncertainty, that it sounded like the construction inspectors in the past for the commission had interpreted the provision one way, and commission may be viewing it a little bit differently. So we're here to seek clarification and provide information about the type of construction method that is being proposed and why it's being proposed and how, in our view, it is preferential to other methods that could be used, and it doesn't negatively impact the topsoil. So I think that, along with there was some discussion about stockpiling as well, and I think based on discussions with Blattner Energy, they have a good explanation of how they what they do with the topsoil that remains removed during the life of the project, and I think that helps give us more clarity on that issue as well.
Very good, Molly. Thank you. That's helpful. Sure. So you guys can, I think, just proceed.
Yeah, I'm just going to turn it over to Dan and let him do a little introduction, and then we'll just, as we're going along, let the next person introduce the following so that we can keep it moving.
All right. What I'm going to do is just give you a very quick, brief overview of Capital Power, because I suspect you've probably already been provided with information about us. But we are an independent power producer. We have been in business for over 100 years. We started out as a local power company, and we have anywhere from coal plants to, as you know, wind power plants, both in Canada and the U.S. This will be our seventh wind plant that we will build. So we're not brand new to the business, but we have brought somebody with us that's even more experienced, which is Blattner Energy, which is going to be our contractor to do this particular build. We, being an independent power producer, we actually own and operate all the plants that we build, so we're here to stay. We're not intending to be doing a quick flip or anything like that, like a bank might be doing on a wind build. So we very much want to be a part of the neighborhood, part of the community. That's what our goal is. And what we're, as Molly has explained, what we're after is to get an interpretation or clarification on the topsoil segregation. We're going to provide some information on what Blattner Energy normally does on the wind farms that they've been building, and they've built about 30% of the wind farms in North America. So you have a sense of just how involved they are in the renewable industry. The last point only is one that we are getting going with the project. We're in the midst right now of doing the engineering for the project, so we have started the engineering on the roads already, and our intent is to start as soon as spring happens in North Dakota. We're hoping that'll be the beginning of May. Okay. So I'll just introduce Bill Erickson from Blattner Energy, who will walk you through the presentation materials that we've provided.
Thanks, Dan. Again, I'm Bill Erickson, Manager of Construction for Blattner Energy, and I'll just give a real brief overview of Blattner Energy and its history and touch a bit on our experience in the wind industry, both nationwide and all through North America. Blattner Energy is part of Blattner Holdings, which has been in existence for 110 years. We're located out of Avon, Minnesota, about 75 miles northwest of Minneapolis. In the handout that you have there, as you scroll through it there, you'll see a map of North America, and that entails projects that we've done not only in the U.S. but also in Canada. The gold is our solar work. The green is the work, the wind farms that have been put in place in Canada by our sister company, Berea. And then the blue dots that you see on that are the wind projects that we've installed across North America as well. And we do have a presence in Puerto Rico with our solar side.
I'm sorry, could you give me the color coding again? Blue is wind?
Yeah, the blue dots that you see right are the Blattner Energy projects that we've installed under Blattner Energy. The green dots that you see on the up in Canada are the ones that are put in by our sister company, a child company of Blattner Holding. That's Berea Construction. And then the gold dots and that you see, the brown dots that you see on there, are the solar projects that Blattner Energy has installed as well.
All right, thank you.
There is the circles that are larger are sometimes multiple phase projects. That's why some are larger and open, and then you have the closed ones, which could be multiple owners and multiple phases of projects. We've done, we'll get into it a little bit behind there, we've done over 35,000 megawatts of installed renewable in the United States, and it's a little bit of a designation that we keep on a larger map just to show that some of these are multiple phase projects. Some of them are standalone projects. Some are multiple phases for different owners in those areas as well. So it's kind of our own designation that we have. We don't have a key that goes with this, but just to designate the Berea stuff that's in Canada in the green. The blue is the wind projects that we've had. And then the gold, if you will, is the solar, to just designate basically the three companies that we have.
But to be clear, you do the engineering, procurement, and construction. You don't own any of these projects.
No, we're an EPC contractor. That is correct. Yeah. Engineer, we procure all the materials with the exception of the turbines themselves. That's typically supplied by the owners. And sometimes the main power transformers, we procure it. Sometimes the owner chooses to procure that themselves. Otherwise, we procure all the materials.
Okay.
And then self-perform the vast majority of the construction. We do subcontract out small portions of it. On this project here, we certainly will be self-performing the civil work, which is kind of the topic of the meeting.
So I see five projects in North Dakota?
Actually, it's a couple pages behind that. Actually, three behind it. It talks about our North Dakota experience. We've actually done nine. The couple of those circles are larger sizes, and they're actually two-phase projects. They're executed under separate contracts, but in North Dakota, we've installed about 1,200 megawatts of wind across the state, 689 wind turbines individually, and that's on nine separate projects, if you will, under nine separate contracts.
Thank you.
Blattner Energy, just overall across the, we talked a little bit about the engineering, the material procurement, pre-construction planning, also the overall construction. We self-perform the electrical work, the civil work. We install the foundations, and we install all of the turbines themselves. So the vast majority of the work that will be performed on this project will be done by Blattner Energy employees. And all of it would be managed under the Blattner employee or Blattner Energy management. So testing, commissioning, and then the overall construction management. So we do manage the subcontractors. We're a sole source of construction services for Capital Power on this project. We've built, as it indicates there, 32,500 megawatts of installed capacity to date in the U.S. and North America. Six of the seven largest wind projects in the U.S. have been built by Blattner Energy. And over 250 projects in COD date, the commercial operation date for the owners, is something we realize is very critical, and we've yet to miss a COD date. Next page is our North Dakota experience. You can see the six different platforms that we've installed. These turbines here are Vestas 3.45 units that we'll be installing. We're certainly familiar with those that we'll be putting up on this project as well. The 232 miles of new and upgraded roads. The 1,378 foundations includes the foundations that are done in substations in the interconnect yards and such as well. Over 500 miles of collection line and 38 miles of transmission line. That's our statistics, if you will, for the state of North Dakota.
Okay, Bill, I want to interrupt you while we're on this page.
Sure.
These nine projects, I assume, are kind of spread around throughout the state. We see the five on the map.
Mm-hmm.
For us going forward, the 689 turbines, 232 miles of new and upgraded roads, mm-hmm. is almost exactly 1 mile for every three turbines. Is that kind of a safe rule of thumb, you think, to use in developing wind farms, that for every three turbines, we probably figure a mile of road?
It might be a little bit misleading, because a lot of what is included in there is the upgraded roads. So that would be existing county or township roads that we would be improving to ensure that the components can be brought in. Now, the actual disturbance of new access road would be a much smaller percentage of that on a per turbine basis. And I don't have the exact statistics of what that is, but that does include, you know, you might go a full section or a mile or two down a county road that would be upgraded with some aggregate and improvements on it to ensure that the turbine components can be delivered. So those are, that's really just an upgrade, and it's not new disturbance, if you will. The actual percentage of access roads that are specifically for the turbines themselves is a much lower percentage of that.
Is that something that's ever been kept track of, that you can readily provide us a statistic on that?
Certainly, I could provide that and forward it on through Capital Power, who could ensure that you folks get that, absolutely.
I think it would be helpful to just kind of a rule of thumb, be able to see what we're dealing with.
I can let you know basically what it is in the state of North Dakota, which is obviously very, very important, but then also nationwide what that statistics is, if North Dakota is a higher percentage or a lower percentage of what the true actual disturbance roads, if you will, is in comparison to on a per turbine basis.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
You bet.
Anecdotally, I've been looking at acres per turbine,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't bring the spreadsheet, but I just started to look at projects in North Dakota, and I want to say it was, I know it was just over a quarter of land per turbine in terms of the overall footprint of a facility. I want to say 176 acres, but then I would look at other states, and anecdotally it might be half that or even a quarter of that, meaning we would have more. I'm interested in the comparison that you just mentioned, because then we would have more roads access, miles of access roads, et cetera, more disturbance overall. And I guess, you know, it's not pertinent to this, but I do have a question on why it seems anecdotally anyway. We have so many, such a higher ratio in terms of turbines per acre.
I think industry-wide you're going to see that the acres are per turbine that are disturbed is going to increase for a couple of reasons. The sites where there's less readily available transmission is more prevalent now than before. The good wind sites that were very close to transmission were the sites that were built early on in the industry. And a project like this project here that has to build its own transmission line will naturally have to utilize more acreage. The turbines themselves are also getting larger, so there's a larger footprint, if you will, that's required around each turbine that's temporarily disturbed. And you will utilize fewer turbines, but you might have to impact a little larger area per turbine just because the components are so large. It takes more area to lay them down, to bring in bigger cranes for the access roads to come in. They have to be large enough to handle and allow our larger cranes to walk on it. The collection systems as well, you may have more feeders because of the fact that the turbines are larger, they produce more energy, and you may require more feeders at the substations and such. So I think on an industry average, the actual disturbance per turbine will be for a while, until the platforms get to that 4-megawatt range, will probably still increase for a period of time. Now, once you get to the 4-megawatt platform that is coming out and will be here in a couple of years, I think you'll probably look to see that plateau. But I think I should be able to provide access on average on Blattner Energy projects, what that average acre of disturbance is on a per turbine basis, and maybe even show it on a trend line to see if that's, if what I presented is accurate. But I believe that to be the case because of the transmission requirements that are now required, that a lot more of these projects are having to be built with an interconnect transmission line, because the good sites, if you will, the ones that have easy access to transmission have been scooped up, if you will.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Did that answer your question? Because if so, then I maybe...
Question, but it probably raised another four or five, but again,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to spin off into another area. So I'm good at this point.
I'll work with Dan and get you guys some information on what our trends are showing out there right now. If that helps maybe clarify or answer your question.
Well, I'm curious, since you've done so many of these around the country and as well as within North Dakota, I thought that the question wasn't so much about the amount of disturbed acres per tower, but the amount of acres in the entire footprint per turbine was more in North Dakota than in some other states. And so I'm wondering if that is the case. Are we siting these further apart and just taking extra space compared to what other states are allowing? Or how does your acreage of the entire wind farm footprint per turbine compare in North Dakota to the other projects you've done?
You know, I'd have to take a look at exactly what that looks like, because a lot of times you'll have a 100-megawatt project, and that could be 62 or 63 of a 1.5 unit. It could be 50 of the 2.0 units. It could be 29 of the 3.45 units. So a lot of it is determined by the owner in their wind development of what is the right platform for the project and what's the most like economical, and those decisions are made by the owners in advance. And Dan, maybe you want to speak on that a little bit. What we've seen out there is that more projects going forward are bigger units with less number of units on them.
The industry trend is to have larger units producing more power per turbine. That they're taller. Their blades are longer. It's just the nature of that creates economies of scale, if you wish, in terms of producing the power. So that's where the industry is generally going right now, is higher, bigger, and longer blades. Probably one thing that maybe to bring into this is, and you kind of alluded to it, Bill, is that the amount of megawatts that's produced is really the another way to look at this in terms of the ratio of land to something, because turbines can change, and they will continue to evolve, and we'll get more power out of them. So really the question is, how much land are you using to produce how much power? So really the megawatts per acre of land may be more of a useful way to understand this than to think about it in terms of number of turbines.
And I guess that strays, my question strayed quite a bit from what we're here to talk about, so sorry about that.
Well, just one other point on that, though, but I think they're tied in the sense that we're talking about topsoil disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get into it, it's, you know, it really starts with the footprint and miles of road, and then it gets to technique after that, and I guess what we're talking about is technique, but they are tied.
Right. I think you will see, though, because there are on a 100-megawatt project, and there will be fewer turbines, as Dan indicated, that trend will continue, that we're looking at 4.0 platforms, so you're going to be seeing those 25-turbine projects, where in the past you've seen a lot of 50-turbine projects, and a 50-turbine project will require, obviously, an access road for each one. Even if they're in a long string, they're still going to require the disturbance around the turbine and such. Now, the size of disturbance around each turbine might increase a little bit, but you'll have fewer of them on a 100-megawatt project in the future than what you've seen in the past.
Okay.
Just wind farms in general, the steps that go through the theirs is obviously where we are now in the pre-construction phase. We build out the road structure, the backbone, the spine of the projects. It will be installing the foundations. The installation and the electrical systems will coincide with each other once the foundations are installed, and then we'll get to the reclamation process, which we'll talk about in a bit. You know, we know that we interact with the community. We focus on the project safety and the community safety, and we look to provide quality work out there. In the pre-construction activities, what we do look at, and I've got Jason Oberg, a PE that's licensed here in the state of North Dakota, and then also put together the decommissioning plan and has that available, that's stamped if you folks would like to see that in a bit. We work through the engineering and design just for the economics to ensure that what we're building meets the owner's expectations and requirements, meets all local laws and standards, and also wind industry standards. Procure the material, transportation, surveying, and then, you know, verifying everything with the geotechnical reports. And then kind of to the process of the roads is, you'll see five or six of your next slides is really what transpires when we're going to be constructing the roads and the sites themselves. What I've demonstrated here is that you have the roads that we're dealing with here ultimately are only 16 feet wide, and that allows for the safe access for the turbine components to come in. They're large trucks. Allows for the safe delivery of the concrete and our folks to be able to access the sites. But at the end of the day, it's just a 16-foot wide road. And basically what we do is, in the picture, as you saw there, where the motor grader is stripping topsoil, both the east and west, if you will, is that topsoil just gets peeled back till you get to the subsurface. And then once you get to the subsurface on this project here, through engineering, our plan is to soil stabilize the next 12 inches of the subgrade. And that would basically, you're introducing cement into the...
Can I go? I think now you're...
Go ahead.
So now you're moving to stage two, correct, with the cement, introduction of cement. On stage one,
mm-hmm.
strip topsoil, just to clarify, is that all topsoil? And it will vary in terms of topography. In some areas it might be 4 inches, some areas it might be 8 inches, but it's all topsoil it's stripped down to?
We strip it down to, and I'll let Jason talk to that point, but it is... We do have a standard that we typically utilize, and Jason will explain the logic behind that.
Sure. Okay, thank you, Bill. Yeah, so our plan on this particular site would be to strip up to 6 inches of topsoil, and then once we reach that point, the topsoil would be broadcast on each side of the road. It would be windrowed and then flattened out to a width that extends anywhere from 15 to 20 feet either side of the edge of the road. At that point, it would be subject to reseeding and stabilized over the course of the project. There's a few areas you can appreciate where we're... And by the way, how much time do we have left here? Just before I go on a tangent here. Okay. Okay, sounds good. Okay, there are a few areas where we'd extend beyond a 16-foot road width, and that'd be along curves in order to make the turbine components work. So those are isolated areas. But our general plan would be to take the topsoil up to 6 inches deep. We'd side cast on either side of the road. That side casting would be very thin, 3 to 4 inches thick. That would extend 15 to 20 feet each side of the road. That would then be reseeded, and at that point, that we consider that stabilized, and then per our SWIP plan, we'd be able to manage any sediment or stormwater runoff. At that point, concurrent to that, we'd be stabilizing the subgrade using up to a 6% cement mixture, scarified 12 inches, and moistened, treated, and compacted. And on top of that, we'd be installing up to 6 inches of base aggregate, which should be used as a driving surface.
So up to 6 inches of topsoil. If the topsoil is 8 inches or 10 inches in a particular area, you're going over the top of some of it.
That's correct. And then that's where the cement stabilization is also helping us. So the cement stabilization, obviously, once we mix in the topsoil with the the main subgrade and we mix in the cement, that cement serves as a bridging effect to stabilize that subgrade sufficiently where we'd be able to compact and moisten treatment and then use aggregate over the top.
And just to interject here from the phone, is the 6 inches in consistent with what we have spelled out in the certification document for how much of the topsoil?
Commissioner Fedorchak, this is Molly. That's the actual issue because as I understand it, the construction inspectors have viewed that you only segregate what you remove. So if you remove 4 inches, you segregate it. If you remove 6 inches, you segregate it. I think during the discussions that during the administrative meetings, there were maybe an interpretation thrown out that if it's 12 inches, you have to remove all 12 inches. And so that's where the confusion is coming in.
Well,
I thought it was if there is 12 inches, you remove 12 inches, but if there is only 6 inches, we aren't going to make you take 6 inches of topsoil and 6 inches of subsoil to equal 12 inches.
That's true, right. Yeah, no, that is accurate.
That you're supposed to take as much as exists, and knowing that in North Dakota there's places where there's only 2 inches, but if there is 12 inches and you're only taking 6 inches, then I think that's where you would be deviating from the certification document, as I recall it, but I'd need Pat to jump in and remind me because I don't have one.
Julie,
in front of me.
Oh, sorry, Julie. I'll help you out on that. On point number 15, you're right. It our item number 15 on the order. It states company understands and agrees that topsoil up to 12 inches, or topsoil to the depth of cultivation, whichever is greater, et cetera, shall be carefully stripped and segregated from the subsoil.
And so, as we understand it in the past, that is. According to the construction inspectors, and Jerry could jump in if I'm mischaracterizing this, but that the method of if there's 12 inches and if you are only taking 6, you segregate that 6, not that you have to take 12. And so on the roads, that's not what has been applied in the past. So there's a difference interpretation between what the construction inspectors are allowing versus what we have gotten as a response to date, and so that's why we're here.
Okay, well, so I'm going to, I think we have not one, but two problems actually here, at least I do, with what you're talking about. First of all, to me, that topsoil is the most valuable resource, natural resource we have in the state. Everything needs to be saved. Not if there's a place where there's a foot of real topsoil, we can't be taking 6 inches off the top and packing the rest with concrete and aggregate and forgetting about it. That is valuable, valuable resource. I think it all needs to be taken to 12 inches. But on the flip side of that, if, you know, probably the most likely occurrence is on a hilltop of land that's been previously farmed, there, because of mistakes of the past, there might not be 6 inches of topsoil. And if there's only 1 inch of topsoil, it does no good to then mix 5 inches of subsoil into your stockpile and someday when it gets respread, have crappy topsoil. We've done this for decades in the mines. They watch what they're doing, and the color changes with the soil, and you know, it can't be precise down to the teaspoon, but your operators out there can see what they're doing, but we need to be saving this topsoil and not losing it. Once it's lost, it's gone forever.
The geotechnical report for this site, which we have borings for each proposed foundation, and we have borings in the substation and Fermet station as well, indicates that topsoil depth does vary significantly across the site. It's as shallow as in some cases there is no topsoil. Some cases, I think on average, it's anywhere from, I think I saw, 4 to 6 inches. In other cases, it's up to 30 inches, according to the report. So it does vary significantly. So the real question is here, where we exceed 6 inches of topsoil, how we treat this, right? So our plan up to this point for previous projects in North Dakota has been to use a 6-inch method. And then the question is, once we go to reclamation and decommissioning down the road at the end of the service life, we would take that cement-treated subgrade, and that would be pulverized and decompacted, and then that would be re-spread throughout the site. And then the topsoil, which should be laying dormant over the course of the design life on the edge of the road, that would be broadcast back in, and then the original contours would be established back to pre-existing or pre-development, if you will.
Can you clarify yet another point for me, please? Did you say broadcast?
Yeah, when I say broadcast, I'm talking about taking a motor grader and side casting the topsoil. So this is the photo that Bill had shared in the handout.
No, I thought we were talking about the concrete aggregate.
No, I'm talking about cement stabilization. So the cement stabilized subgrade would be decompacted, okay. And then that would be mixed in and used to reestablish the site during the decommissioning phase.
So I'm going to ask a few questions just to clarify a couple points. So, Jason, if there are only 2 inches of topsoil, you're not taking 2 inches of topsoil and 4 inches of subsoil and mixing them, are you?
No, that is correct.
And so you're still
only be the 2 inches of topsoil. In order to minimize as much, we're trying to minimize disturbance as much as possible. So in this case, we'd only take the 2 inches in your example, and then the rest would remain. We'd still stabilize, but then we would not be removing any subgrade below that 2 inches.
Okay, so we are not mixing topsoil and subsoil, so that's one key issue. The second is from an impact to the topsoil perspective. I mean, I think there's a presumption that if you do not remove it and you mix concrete with it, you're somehow destroying the qualities of the topsoil. Can you speak to whether that is the case?
Yeah, it's not the case. The cement, when we speak of cement, it's not like you think about a sidewalk out here with 100% impermeability. Once these are decompacted, that cement-treated subgrade really becomes structurally, let's just say, unstable, and that breaks down over time. And over the course of likely the design life of the plant, which in this case is about 45 years, and then beyond, once it's decompacted, that cement just starts breaking down over time, and that blends in with the local topsoil. And the pH values stabilize over time, and whatever we had pre-development versus post-development basically stabilizes.
I have a couple follow-up questions, if I could. One of them is related to, Molly, your comments about the inspectors, and I want to set that aside for a minute and talk about why are you not just taking all the subsoil and putting the concrete mix in subsoil and doing it that way? Why aren't you, and why do you prefer not to do that?
Well, there's a few reasons. The main reason, we're trying to minimize disturbance. We're trying to take as least as we can. And structurally speaking, from a performance perspective, we only need to take the top 6 inches.
Well, then why wouldn't you just leave it all and make the case for leaving all of it if it doesn't jeopardize it at all? Why are you taking any?
Why are we taking any?
Yeah.
Oh, well, the reason
you're saying you're trying to minimize disturbance and this, you know, building a road on top of it doesn't affect the quality of the subsoil, why are you not here making a case for just building the road on top of it, on top of all of the subsoil and not taking any of it away?
Well, the answer for that is the top 6 inches, so that's the what we'd call the disturbed layer. That's been aerated over time. It's structurally basically unsound. The soil below that's generally more consolidated. So again, from a performance perspective, it's more advantageous to take that. We're talking about, you know, deep topsoil here. It's more advantageous to take that top 6 inches versus going deeper. In our experience, if we can remove that disturbed layer, that let's just call it the weaker layer, remove that strata and then replace that, stabilize it, and then replace that with that same depth with an aggregate base, that does two things. It stabilizes subgrade. It gives us a structurally sound base to travel on, provide component access, and then it also maintains as closely as possible the original contours, so we're not changing any of the hydrologic properties of the site.
So but you could take all the topsoil if there's more than 6 inches and still have a stable subsoil with which to do the same thing.
Yes, but we'd also be inducing extra cost as well. Again, we're trying to minimize cost minimize ground disturbance and then while providing a safe and accessible site. So again, in the name of economy, we're trying not to go any deeper than necessary and not disturb any more ground than necessary.
Okay. So when you're talking...
Well, it's definitely, I'm not quite done, Brian. It's definitely not what we're saying in the certification document. So, and so I'm curious why, when before the document was signed, weren't we having these discussions about that this doesn't conform to how you intend to construct and you want a variance?
So, Julie, this is Molly. One reason is that the EPC wasn't selected until recently, and these questions came up in the discussions with selecting a contractor. The question was, we plan to comply. This seems we have a question about this, and we want to come forward. So it wasn't an issue that we were aware of at the time of getting the permit or of getting the continuation of the permit. So that's why it came up more recently. And we came to Jerry originally with a question, and then it's elevated from there. So that's why right. We are where we are.
Yeah. Now, regarding the inspectors, that sounds very anecdotal to me, Molly and Jerry. Like, what are we talking about in the inspectors are saying who, which projects. I mean, this is the first I've heard about that. I haven't seen this in the inspection report. It's not consistent with what's spelled out in the certification document. So I would expect that these inspectors are coming to us with those kind of variances. So I'm not inclined to say, oh, it's what's happening already. Let's do more of it. When we don't have any, I don't even know if it's one time it's happened, one inspector, or where to go with those comments that this is what the quote-unquote inspectors are saying.
Oh, this is Molly. I can't speak to that because this came through Jerry, so I'll let him speak.
So I only asked one inspector what they were doing, and they had read the certification document to say that they have to segregate the topsoil that is removed. They didn't read it to say that they have to remove all of the topsoil. And I think that was the common interpretation. I don't know what everybody's
doing. Why do you think that was the common interpretation, Jerry? Why do you say that?
It was my interpretation, too. I mean, reading the document. The topsoil that you need to be removed needs to be segregated.
That's not how it's written.
Yeah.
I'm just astounded at how we would conclude that this should just be wasted as valuable as topsoil
well,
is in
I
the
don't
state.
Think it's wasted. It stays right there.
If you mix it in with aggregate and things like that, it's pretty much
it's not.
Wasteful.
It's not being mixed with aggregate.
The aggregate
goes over the top of the topsoil in this case.
So, Julie, are you wrapped up, or do you have some more?
Well, for now, I guess.
Okay, this is, I have a couple of questions, or one related to two measurements, and in effect, they're a moot point if the topsoil, as is stated, is removed up to a depth of 12 inches, it really becomes irrelevant. But with that said, you talked about eventually the concrete material, is that correct, breaks down over the course of time.
It's cement. It's not concrete.
Cement.
Concrete, technically, you're talking about
porous
aggregate. Okay,
cement. Yeah. Have you done any studies over the course of time on over a period of 10 years, pH goes from this level to that level, it's unchanged. Mm-hmm. Have you done any soil productivity measurements in terms of would a producer say, you know what, say it was tillable ground and no measurable difference on the yield monitor when they're combining down what was previously a road?
Yeah, we've not done those specifically ourselves, but I can refer you to some studies done by others that have studied this topic about how how the presence of a cement stabilized base using 6% cement content in this case would affect the long-term pH balance. So I can provide some information.
One point that one of the commissioners here made, that where the topsoil in the mining industry is very carefully segregated out along, and also having quite a bit of experience in the mining industry as well, the overburden is also, you know, segregated out while the ore body is being mined, and then reclamation process takes place. And that's typically in large mining is over the course of sometimes even several years, many years. I believe the difference that these wind projects have is that from time we break ground until we're at reclamation, so that operation and maintenance processes do start, is a very short time frame in comparison. We would break ground here, let's say in May, and our reclamation process would start on some of the project just a few months later. So that topsoil that's laterally stored, if you will, on the shoulders of the road is only there in that condition just for a couple of months before our reclamation process gets, we get to our final grading, it's dressed up, and then it's reseeded with an approved mix. So that restabilization of that topsoil laterally, which minimizes any distribution of weeds across a project, where in a large facility you would probably be introducing weeds from one landowner to another if you were going to utilize a stockpiling method out there. This topsoil is literally stockpiled feet from where it is in its current state, and it remains there until the aggregate 45 years from now would be removed. And as Jason described, that top subgrade would be pulverized, and then that topsoil would be blended back into that place where it was literally 45 years in advance. So it remains real within a very short distance, literally feet of where it was removed when the beginning of the process is, and it stays in a lateral storage, if you will, right alongside the edge of the road until it's brought back in. And the actual imprint and footprint of what our actual disturbance, permanent disturbance, if you'll consider 45 years of permanent disturbance, is very minimal with just 16 foot of road. The diameter that's around the turbine, which is, say, 20 foot for the foundation itself, and a driving ring that's around that, that's a very small area of topsoil that's just laterally stored until final reclamation, if you will, at decommissioning 45 years from now.
The lateral storage concept, I mean, you make some good points about it, that certainly it would be cost savings. You're not transporting the material so far. And you're probably keeping the soil with pretty in the same areas as far as weed distribution. The negative, though, of it is I add up the rough numbers. At the end, then, when you spread the topsoil on the original road, instead of having a 16-foot path that is going to be needed to reseeded, after you pull the couple inches of topsoil off of the lateral boundaries on each side, you're going to have about a 50-foot width that is going to have to be reseeded again, because you will have pulled the top couple inches off.
Yep.
And so for erosion issues and just getting a good start, if it's a drought year, you know, sometimes things have to be reseeded. You've experienced that in the mining industry, I'm sure. It seems like you're basically at least tripling the amount of reclamation work you have to do, especially in, you know, this industry is working a lot on hilltops and stuff where it's probably going to be the toughest to get a good grass mixture started and to replace what was disturbed. So aren't you concerned about that, enhancing the area that's going to have to be ultimately reseeded?
Jason talked to what we current wind industry practices are in comparison to what you're discussing, which is more along the line of how the mining industry handles theirs.
Yes, so you're right. You're adding to the seeding area, but you're not tripling the work necessarily. If you compare the difference of stockpiling versus what we're talking about, windrowing method and flattening, you're actually inducing more emissions, we'd argue, if you're stockpiling, because now you've got to bring in different equipment. And that equipment now is going to triple, because now instead of just using a single blade, now you've got blading, and now you've got a heavy haul truck, dump truck, and then you're going to have a front-end loader to scoop up the topsoil and then haul up that new haul truck and then stockpile that somewhere. And then we've got to, in addition, of course, we've got to account for wind erosion over time to that stockpile and ensure that we have the same volume that removed is the same volume that's going to be replaced. And in the case of stockpiling, I would argue that's more difficult to attain when you've got a higher wind profile caused by stockpile in a high wind zone, hence the wind farm. And
well, we seed our stockpiles so that they don't blow.
We seed them, but with a higher wind profile, it's more difficult to reestablish that seed over time and ensure over the case of 45 years we're minimizing wind erosion, right? That's, we could have a drought year, right, and we're losing our protective cover, and we could be opening things up and likely losing more volume than what we took out. And so in order to maintain the exact amount that we took out and return back again during the reclamation phase, we believe, in our experience and in best practice, that the windrowing method that we're proposing induces less emissions, less cost, and ensures more certainty of returning the same exact topsoil back to where it came from at the same location where it came from without inducing different types of topsoils from different parcels and mixing those up and increasing the chance of noxious weeds occurring.
Jason, when you transport, you would also then be increasing the impact to the other land by transporting that to a stockpile location. Is that correct?
Right. We're likely going to be increasing ground disturbance in addition to emissions because now we've got to find a place to stockpile. And that's got to be designated. Now that's taken out of agriculture production or land use for that landowner and also incurring extra burdens on them as well over the course of 45 years.
And Jason, is this standard, what you're describing, standard in the industry? You're not seeing the stockpiling as a standard method?
Yeah, correct? That is correct. And in my experience, we've never been required to stockpile topsoil. So.
And I want to go back to the roads for a second because I think we need to explain further some of the downside of removing, if we have 12 inches of topsoil, the downside of removing that from an erosion perspective from the amount of aggregate and how that would, you know, the requirements to haul that in, haul that out. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, your question, I assume, Molly, is on the basis of that we'd be stockpiling this? Or
no, I'm just talking about the roads and your if you had to remove 12 inches and you have a 12-inch hole in the ground, what's the downside to having that 12-inch hole from a perspective of erosion, of maintaining the contour for landowner use?
Yes, that's correct. Again, we only need, again, I referred to earlier, structurally speaking, from a performance perspective, a safety perspective, we only need 6 inches of base aggregate. So if we go down to 12 inches, for example, now we have a 6-inch depression, which now changes the hydrologic properties. We're increasing the potential for erosion, which is a violation, of course, of our storm management pollution prevention best practices, which will be required, a SWIP plan, as we're all familiar with, which is required as part of this project. So we're trying to minimize, again, ground disturbance, land disturbance. We're trying to maintain the same hydrologic properties that existed before development. And in order to do that, we need to maintain the original contours as closely as possible. Hence, if we're only going to install 6 inches of aggregate, then therefore we should only be removing up to 6 inches of topsoil in order to maintain the same hydrology. If we have to remove 12 inches, now we have a 6-inch depression. That acts as a trough during a major stormwater event. And now we have erosion controls. The owner has maintenance concerns that they have to account for. And the landowner also is affected by this because now we may have sedimentation runoff, which affects their crops, their agriculture production, and causes burden on the landowner as well.
Well, I'll tell you, there's not that many places where you're going to find a foot of topsoil. In my opinion, where you find it, it ought to be saved. And you also must have some material that you work with out of your foundations. Haul some of that in before you put your subgrade down. It seems like there's all kinds of solutions if there's any desire at all to save this resource.
Can I ask a question? Because you keep referencing to it needs to be saved, and I think that's what we're trying to explain, is it is being saved. It's just being saved in place. It's not being destroyed. It's not being removed. It's actually staying where it was located, and when the project is done, it's still there. It's still usable. I think we're having a hard time trying to explain how to get past that destroyed concept because we're not understanding it.
Well, I'm concerned about it being saved underneath a layer of cement-stabilized subgrade.
It is part of the cement-stabilized subgrade. It's part of the cement is added to it correctly.
That is correct. Right. The cement is added and mixed up to a scarified depth of 12 inches, which constitutes our stabilized subgrade.
Right. And then at the reclamation, your aggregate is removed, correct? So there is no aggregate mixed in with the topsoil that remains.
Correct. The aggregate is removed, just as you described, and the advantage of the cement stabilized subgrade is it provides a relatively clean surface for removing that aggregate in layers, right, a clean layer, versus say if you're not cement and you're just simply pounding that aggregate into the subgrade, now you're right, then you'd have a mixed condition and that causes some issues. But the advantage of the cement stabilized subgrade, imagine this table surface here, provides a relatively flat and clean surface in which to draw that aggregate off of. And in that case, once we're exposing that cement treated subgrade, now we pulverize and then we mix in that topsoil of what we had removed 45 years earlier, and that's during the decommissioning phase.
Have you decommissioned any projects where you've actually done the restoration for these types of projects?
No, I've been involved in wind since 2003, and the projects I've been involved in are still yet to be decommissioned. So,
can you explain one? Go back to one point you made on wind erosion.
Mm-hmm.
And can you explain to me, because maybe I'm missing something, if the topsoil is stockpiled, it's going to be stockpiled at a greater depth, correct, than it would be windrowed at?
Yes, correct. Yep.
So it would seem to me that from a surface area standpoint, the windrowing method is going to expose just as much topsoil to wind erosion, because you're going to have the same problem with reestablishing vegetation if we're in a drought.
Mm-hmm.
So can you...
Yeah.
But that's
a good question.
Thought process seems to contradict what you said. So can you explain that to me?
Absolutely. Yep, that's a good question. Yeah, the concern with the stockpiling method with respect to wind erosion is now we're in a higher wind profile. You're right, you're going to expose the same area, basically. Although you're exposing less area with stockpiling, you're going to be exposing more topsoil area with the method we're discussing. But the issue with the stockpiling is if we're higher in the wind profile, if you look at familiar with the boundary layer of wind gust obviously increases with respect to height. And if we're higher in that wind profile, let's just pick a height. Let's pick 30 or so feet we're stockpiling. That's going to be subject to greater wind gusts than it is if it's on the ground, in which it's subject to very low wind gusts. And so therefore, if the wind velocity is higher, it's going to increase the potential for wind erosion much greater than if the topsoil is closer to the ground. That's the rationale.
One item that you'd mentioned about utilizing the excavated material around the foundations to be able to use as fill material if additional topsoil was removed is that the excavated material actually is required to be put back in place at a much higher density than its natural condition out there. And all that material is backfilled at those foundations as stabilization ballast, if you will, over the top. So there truly is no excess material, even though there's several hundred yards of concrete being placed in there. But the in situ material that's excavated, that is put back in a much higher density there, so that all that material is utilized at the sites themselves, and there is no generation of borrow or waste material, if you will, available.
Yeah. Do you want to ask more questions? Do you want to hear from from Yabo from his perspective as a Soil Conservation Service rep from McHenry County. How would you, would that be helpful?
I think it would be.
Sure.
Thank you. Stockpiling, as opposed to mining or to or for a gravel pit, for example, they'll stockpile the topsoil there. And the big concern there is, just like Jason said, is the more wind erosion. My viewpoint of what's going on here is, I think everything that they are planning to do fits right with the goal of our soil conservation district, and that is to prevent wind or soil erosion, whether it be wind or water erosion. When they're spreading that out, not only as opposed to stockpiling, they're also planting suitable species of grasses that are conducive to the soil types. So not the stockpiling, you're going to lose oxygen through carbonization and such. Where you plant grasses on there, now you're actually generating oxygen and also the, and to a degree, some more topsoil is going back in just through the natural decomposition of the grasses. Did that answer any question?
Well, I want to follow up with a question.
Yeah.
I will tell you that our experience from hundreds of thousands of acres of mining is that yes, the first couple of years after that topsoil has been in a stockpile for significant amounts of time, the growth isn't, you know, what you would expect if it had been out and having growth material in it, but it regenerates pretty quickly. The flip side, though, where my question is, I'm just lost at how a I get the point about the emissions issues and fuel issues and even compaction issues with hauling this stuff. But when we're talking about the erosion, I can't imagine how a big pile of, you know, 6 or 8 foot thick stockpile of topsoil that is seeded over would have more erosion than a 2-inch veneer spread out over miles. That just doesn't even seem logical. The erosion factor has to be far less in a stockpile situation than just painting a veneer along the edge of the road for miles, does it not?
There's greater potential, is it? Oh, I'm sorry.
Like
go ahead.
Soil conservation person to answer.
My experience would be that by spreading that 2 inches of topsoil, you're putting that on top of original topsoil along the edge of the road. Mm-hmm. You're already going to have some natural grasses there that are going to come through, and plus there will be seeding more grasses on top of the stuff that's spread. I would, my personal experience, being a farmer all my life and working with soil conservation grasses and plantings, that grass would take over and it would hold the soil just as much as if it was in a stockpile.
Okay.
Is that the same question I had asked earlier about the wind erosion, or are you talking about water erosion as well?
I'm talking about both, but
did you answer for both wind and water erosion?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So all-inclusive answer, so to speak. Okay.
And I guess one of the other questions would be your thoughts as far as the road construction method and whether that has a negative impact on the topsoil that would remain within the bed of the road. If you could speak to that, that would be helpful as well.
Okay, well, I'm not a soil specialist, but I took a number of soils classes at NDSU. In the decommissioning, we're talking?
Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a farm field around the edge of this decommissioned road, That's topsoil. You're going to end up with, to way I understand, another, you're going to have 6 inches of topsoil on top of the original road.
Yes.
The farmers will just be able to go drive across that and level it out, and that should be, boy, if that changed the over the 45 years, if that has changed the condition of that topsoil, it's going to be very little in my experience.
For our record, you said you're not a soil specialist. For our record, what is your background that
I
for providing the expertise for us today, please?
I've taken soil classes at NDSU, and I've been a farmer all my life. I've worked with soil, and I've been the manager of our soil conservation district, dealing with in hundreds of grass seedings on land that has been broke up and reseeded, and stopping wind and water erosion, whether it be by planting trees or by planting grasses.
And how long have you been with the Soil Conservation Service?
11 years.
And you're in McHenry County, right?
Yes.
And that's where this project is located, right?
That's correct. They're in my district.
Are you a participant?
In the wind farm, do you have a lease with the company for the wind farm?
Are you comfortable with the...
I didn't hear the answer to the lease.
He's not. He's not a leased landowner.
Are you comfortable with in going through the valleys where there might be more than 6 inches of topsoil, with the concept of the lower 6 inches ultimately being left mixed with the cement stabilized subgrade?
Yes.
Okay. Have you seen that in practice or experienced that in your career?
No, I have not.
And is this for the soil conservation expert as well as the other folks there? Is this a new method, or is this something that's been done widely for a long time?
This is Bill Erickson with Blattner. The method that we propose on using is industry standard, and not only U.S.-wide, but I can also include Canada from firsthand experience that stripping topsoil from 4 to 6 inches. Sometimes you introduce a soil stabilized base in some areas. It's not necessary due to the composition of material, but in soils such as this is a very standard, industry standard practice that, again, is utilized across North America.
For road construction, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Does that conclude everybody's remarks that they wanted to make?
Joe, you've been quiet. I'm not sure what group you're with, or did you have another perspective on this?
No, I would just add that our goal, number one, is to protect topsoil. We're going to be in the area for a long time. We stand behind the landowners, the farmers, the ranchers, and we've asked Yabo to come in basically on his own behalf. Just we went through a lot of this with him over the last couple of days because we want his input. Obviously, we want to be good neighbors, and our goal is to treat the land right, treat the landowners as best we can, and we value his input. We appreciate him joining us today, but we also want to make sure, you know, we're following the prescription of the PSC and the state of North Dakota, so that's why we've come to ask for this clarification.
And I'm sorry, I couldn't write fast enough when we were doing introductions. Are you with Blattner or Capital? Or
I'm with Capital Power.
Okay.
we do appreciate Jerry setting up this informal hearing. Thank you.
I don't have other questions, but I'm going to ask staff for some material, so I'll turn it over here to Brian and then wrap it up with Julie as far as questions for the company.
I have one last question, potentially one last question. When you are windrowing, I'm looking at the, I was looking at the cross-section diagram. In an area that has, what's a typical width in terms of the windrow outside of the 16-foot area on either side of the road? I would guess they're approximately equal widths.
Yeah, it's right around 10 to 15 feet on either side of the road. And that's spread out anywhere from 2 to 4 inches thick.
Okay, so it will vary based on the depth of the topsoil in that particular location?
Yeah, that's correct.
So an area that may have 12 inches of topsoil, the windrow is going to be deeper?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Julie?
I don't have any other questions. Thanks.
Did you have any comments or any requests of staff or anything?
I mean, I appreciate the company coming forward and recognizing that this is different from what the certification document spells out. We've been pretty fussy about this segregation of the topsoil and the subsoil. We did a lot of work on this with pipeline development. I recognize it's a little different here, but there's still large areas that are impacted by the road construction and the gathering lines. So I want, if anything, I think that we might need to talk about a different standard for road construction, which we don't have. So that's just what I'm thinking right now. I still want to kind of muddle over the information.
Okay, Brian?
No, nothing else at this time.
So my thought is this. I thought on all of our various projects that it was clear enough that topsoil is segregated up to a foot, except for coal mining, which segregates it all if it's 10 feet thick. I wish we had some places like that, but that would be the extreme. And so I'm surprised that there's even a question with it, but as for this other information, I'm just going to throw this out there because I won't be around to see it happen probably, but I really think someday with this veneering this topsoil out into the area beside the road, then it's going to get to be reclamation time, and whoever is around to reclaim it is going to be making these same points about what an enormous cost it is, and there's the emissions issue. Now we have to run equipment over 50 feet of ground, and it's going to cause compaction issues. It's not just a matter of stripping 2 inches off then, because now you've compacted. Now you have to scarify that ground that's minus the 2 inches, and it all has to be reseeded, and so then there's going to be another round of erosion. So why don't we just abandon the roads? I really think that's the end result, but I can't know that, but I'm just throwing it out because there's not much doubt in my mind, but it's not really the issue that we're necessarily left with here today. I'm going to ask staff though to do some research, maybe check in with NDSU or our state soil conservation about this concept of mixing the cement stabilized subgrade in with topsoil in places where topsoil is deeper and was left in place, and what their thoughts are and the impact of that, because I'm kind of taken aback by that could possibly be all right. And I'm going to ask the company to, I think you said 6% cement, mm-hmm. but I don't know if there's different types of cement, or give us or me something in writing that we can use, because I think, you know, before this hearing, if someone had asked me what I think of cement stabilized subgrade, I'd have said, I don't know what that is. And so as we try and research it, I think we'll get the same answer. So
sure.
I'm looking for a definition of that.
Commissioner, I believe that Jason offered some citations on the PH. Would you like those as well?
Very much.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Yep.
And oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, pH, and then also anything related to soil productivity measurements.
Sure. Yep.
If it's available.
Yep.
And not that we're trying to rush you or anything, but these guys are planning to start construction in May, and that's why we originally came in February asking the question. And so do you guys have a sense of how the next steps, and we want to make sure that they know what they're doing, you know, before we get out in the field to start construction on the, and the roads will be first.
Well, this maybe sounds like a pat answer, but I think we've got an incredible record for at least 5+ years, but I think it goes back before that, of really trying to move everything along as quickly as we possibly can, but to get the information we need and make good decisions. But I don't know how long it'll take. How long will it take to get a good definition of that I've asked for, and then see, I mean, is there any history of a study on something like this where someone else has done this? I don't know how long it'll take, but I sure always hope to move things along as quickly as possible.
Well, we'll try to get our information to you as soon as we can.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I would echo the same thoughts. You're asking for a deviation from the written order, which raises a number of questions. Randy, Commissioner Christman mentioned a few that he had. Staff is probably thinking, okay, we're going to be busy with something else, because they'll have three different commissioners asking them questions. Mm-hmm. So because of that, now I've got some homework to do.
Sure. And I guess I just come back to remembering that, as I understand it, this isn't a deviation from practice. It's a deviation from... in some ways, we ask the question because we're trying to be good citizens, make sure we understand. So I think it's possible that it's already been using this method given what we've understood. So we hope that that's taken into consideration in making the decision, that we aren't varying from or proposing something that's varying from industry standard. We're just understanding the interpretation a little bit differently, apparently, than some of the other others have in the past. So
no, I understand that, sure. Which is why I said written order.
Sure.
The written order, and that's actually something, the comparison that I'll be asking for some more information on our end to follow up on.
Okay. Anything else, Julie?
Yeah. Did I get cut off, or did I just? You stopped hearing me, or could you not hear me at all the last time I spoke?
We don't know when the last time you spoke.
We heard you the last time we heard, yeah.
Okay. Well, did I just trail off? Because all of a sudden you were talking, and I was still talking.
Oh, I'm sorry. We heard some beeping that I assume was you being cut off, so I don't know.
Okay. How else. That makes sense. All right. So anyway, I think that I do appreciate the company coming forward with their recognition that this is slightly different than, or could be interpreted differently through the certification. So I think we just need to do our best to get through and get you an answer as soon as we can. And it strikes me that there's perhaps some clarification that just needs to speak to how construction of roads is handled, which is probably different than the other areas of construction on a project, and we just haven't dealt with that question before. So we have to be a little patient while we work through that and get the information we need to make a good policy for this project and others in the future.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Now you're done, right?
I am done now.
Okay. Are there any objections to the evidence produced becoming part of the official record, and the evidence is, would be both the documents that you brought as well as the oral discussion today?
None from me.
Oh, before we get to that,
there are a couple things you asked for during the hearing. I was wondering if those are still, you still want those to be included with the record as late filed exhibits. The disturbance per acre trends, as well as the acres per turbine in North Dakota. I think those are two things you specifically requested between the two of you.
Yeah, if that's something that you can produce without.
Again, that would just be specific to the projects that Blattner Energy has performed.
Sure. Okay.
Right.
We've done quite a bit of the work, but certainly not all of the work.
Okay.
And if that's something that's not in a database, that's going to take. I guess I don't feel like I definitely have to have that. I would appreciate it.
I'll investigate and see if we have it. I believe we have it.
We don't want to hold this up because of you having to do a lot of work to gain that. That would just be helpful information. But
I would agree. If it's easily accessible, I have my own spreadsheet, actually, in terms of different states, different projects that I've pulled and just averaged out number of turbines by the overall footprint, and that's where I've come up, you know, anecdotally, that's where I've noticed. But since I don't have every project, I can only say anecdotally.
I think it's something that I can put together pretty easily, honestly.
Good, thank you.
I also wanted to point out that since this is part of the order, if there was supposed to be a change to the certification documents, we'd probably require a notice of opportunity to be done as well.
Okay.
That was my concern to begin with originally, and there wasn't a notice
done, you know, for opportunity for hearing before this informal. So is there a way, can we move forward with the notice of opportunity for hearing if you ultimately change your mind?
Wouldn't you trigger that, Molly, by requesting to change the order?
Well, see, we discussed this, and if it's an interpretation issue, that's not a change of the order. So it depends.
I don't think it's an interpretation issue. I think that certification document is going to need to be altered, in my opinion.
So if that's the case, then, I mean, that's what we want, if that's what it needs to happen. Do we just need to file a request, and can we start the clock on that?
If I was there, I'd be nodding my head.
Okay, I'm reading nodding.
Yeah, and Jack, just want you, since it's under discussion, will you just explain the process of?
Sure. So we would have to just do a notice of opportunity, but that would be upon the issuance of the notice date. And that would be essentially the beginning of that time clock. And I believe it's 20 days for a notice of opportunity. And after that, from publication, right. Thanks, Jerry. And upon that, we could probably make a decision if there is no request for a hearing within those 20 days.
Okay. Now I think everyone is done.
Just a comment, and that's
sure.
We really do appreciate this opportunity to be able to come in and present some information to you folks, be able to share what we know about the industry, and certainly we'll abide by whatever decision you folks decide on.
Well, and I also appreciate you guys coming in and seeking clarification. So now I'm going to ask again, since we've done a fair amount of talking since, if there's any objection to the evidence, both written and oral, becoming part of the record?
No, and we will submit everything that you've requested as a late-filed Exhibit 5.
Perfect, thank you. So then the evidence will become part of the record, upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record? Then we are closed. Again, thank you all for being here.
Thank you.